Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the EPDP small, pardon me, let me start again, and welcome to the EPDP Data Elements Workbook taking place on Tuesday, the 5th of February, 2019 at 1730 UTC. In interest of time, we'll do no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect. If you're only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Dan, it appears your Adobe Connect logged in as audio only, but we see you on here as well. So we'll take an account if that you may at times just be on audio only. Seeing or hearing no one further, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to Barry Cobb. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. Barry Cobb for the record. And can you give me an audio check? Am I coming in clear?
Great. Your audio is wonderful. Thank you for testing.
Great. Thank you. So for today's meeting, we're going to start off with a quick check of where we're at to date in terms of applying some of our new logic changes to the workbooks. And then hopefully we have agreed on that sanity check. Then I'd like to run us through very quickly on a couple of sidebar comments I've highlighted in purposes 1 through 3. Then we'll move down into purposes 4 through 7. And hopefully we'll get through those. Lastly, we'll talk about the consolidated data elements table and take a look at that. And then hopefully we'll conclude about how we're going to document the lawful basis for each of the processing activities there. So for the sanity check part of the agenda item, just a brief recap to how we got here. After the close of our meeting last Thursday, I applied more of the changes that we had discussed to purposes 1 through 3, which includes a 1A and a 1B. And then secondarily, I think at the close of, at the end of Saturday, I applied the same style types of changes to the remaining workbooks to bring them into somewhat consistency in how we had applied changes to the first three workbooks, or maybe I sent that Friday. And then Saturday, then I manually imported from the data elements tables by purpose into a spreadsheet so that we can view those from a consolidated perspective. And instead of looking at them individually by purpose, we can see how they're stacked together. Looking at it by from a processing activity perspective, and in some cases by a role. So we'll take a look at that as well. So before I move into the first agenda item, which is really to kind of talk through some of the purposes, I'd like to hear from everybody as to what is in front of us right now. Is the logic a little bit more clear or a little bit more clear in terms of how the processing activities are stacked against each other? And then secondarily, the actual data elements tables themselves and the new designations that we're using, do those seem to make more sense, especially now that we're delineating the use of optional? So I'd just like to hear some general feedback that based on what you reviewed, is there a better degree of comfort in how we're documenting these? And if not, then, you know, what subtle changes do we need to make so that I can apply those across each of the workbooks? And once we get to that, then we can move on to an individual review. So I'll open up the queue now. Alan, then Mark, and then Stephanie, please.
Yeah, I'll jump in straight away. So from my reading of it, already it's much clearer. So in my mind, it's clearer, and I'm thankful of that. Obviously, I look forward to going through and cleaning up some of the elements as well, because I'm not necessarily on board with some of them in the sense of the actual data elements and the optional per registrar or optional per registrant, because some of them haven't yet been somewhat decided out of plenary, but that's just me. But generally speaking, this seems so much more clearer to me, and at least in my mind, I think it is much more user-friendly. So thank you. I'm happier, definitely.
Great. Thank you. Mark?
Thanks, Barry. I guess I'll just agree with Alan. You know, I think it's, you know, easier to read and parse. I don't agree with some of the things that are in there. I'm looking at some of these, and they are different. You know, some of the tabs and some of the things in these are still different from what we discussed and what's necessary. So I guess there's some work to do, but I agree with Alan. It's easier to read and parse.
And Stephanie, please go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it yet, but I really appreciate the idea of a consolidated view, because I don't know about the rest of you guys, I can't remember what we've done with the different things, and I need them kind of stacked up together to see how they all fit together, because we are making changes, so you have to see it as a neat thing. So I look forward to this. I think it'll help me figure it out. We don't want any surprises coming in during that quiet 2 weeks where some of us raise our hands and say, this is all, wrong. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Stephanie. And while we have 2 weeks, I think only one of those weeks is quiet, but who's counting? All right. So why don't I go ahead and jump into some of the details. As I went through, as I mentioned, I made a couple of sidebar comments to flag for us to think through some of the logic. Just could use some guidance in regards to finishing these out. So I'm going to move down to 1A, and more specifically at the bottom of the data elements table, I still had some confusion about how we're going to document this end zone IP. And what you'll see in the document now is I still left them as our old optional. And so I guess really, Alan, I'm kind of looking to you in terms of how we're classifying the possible use of end zone IPs. Is it something that is optional that a registrant would supply, or is it optional that the registry would apply? And if it is the registry, should we just make this optional-CP, and then what does that look over to the right as well? Mark, please go ahead, and then Alan.
If I jumped in front of Alan, I think probably optional to optional, so I think I don't know if we need another category of optional. But if you support end zone hosts, then it would be required for you to support it, but optional for the registrant to provide it. I think is ultimately what it needs to say. Or ultimately the message we're trying to carry is, if end zone hosts are supported, then optional to provide and required to support. Yeah, got it.
Can you say that one more time for the record?
If end zone hosts are supported, then it's optional to for the registrant to provide it, but required for the registry to support it.
All right, sorry about that. I was just typing up those notes. Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just going to say, yeah, Mark is on the same page as me. I think in my mind, I'm actually going to defer to him on the technical aspect of it because I'm not as familiar, but can we be, what's the word I'm looking for? Can we deny a registrant if to use an in-zone name server? So as far as I can see, if we cannot deny an in-zone name server, then in my mind it would just be optional of the registrant, and then our requirement flows from there where we would be required to support that. That makes sense to me, but I'm probably confusing matters, so I'm going to stop now, so thank you.
Alan, this is Mark. I'll just jump in. I was actually trying to think of that myself. I actually know of TLDs that that only allow in-zone hosts. So I know of some TLDs that, you know, where you can only use in-zone hosts. I'm trying to think offhand if there's a scenario where you have a TLD that does not allow in-zone hosts, and I'm just not sure off the top of my head. So I was trying to leave the language flexible in case there are TLDs that don't allow in-zone hosts. But I'm just not sure off the top of my head, to be honest.
Dan, please go ahead.
Thank you, Greg. You guys hear me?
Loud and clear.
Thanks. I think, and this is one where I'm with Alan, I'm a lawyer and not an engineer, and maybe we want to check. I mean, I think Mark might know better, or maybe we can get in-house expertise here too, but I think probably what gets confusing is that the IP address of those name servers is part of the, I'll get the wording right, but those are attributes of the name server object and not the domain object. So you have a domain name and it has name servers associated with it, which is just, I think, the host names. And then those host names are going to have their objects in the registry also, which aren't directly tied to the registrant. They're kind of owned and created by the registrar. And then they have IP addresses. And my understanding is the registrant, subject to registry rules about which kind of hosts are allowed, the registrant can pick whatever name servers it wants for its domain. And then the registrar and the registry should respect those as long as they comply with the policies. And I think the rule is then. That I don't know if it's on the registry or the registrar to go in and find out what are the IP addresses for those name servers. The registrant might not even know. And then to put those out into mobile.
Thank you, Dan, and it looks like Mark has a response as well. Go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. Mark Anderson for the transcript. So I guess I'll expand a little on what Dan said. So name servers for most registry operators, name servers are standalone objects. Meaning which is what Dan was getting at when he said you create a name server, a registrar will create a name server at the registry, and when the registrar creates a name server, it assigns it an IP address. So that linking is done at the registrar or at the registry level by the registrar. And that's how, you know, most TLDs operate, but not all. And I'll get to that in a second. But I think the first point I want to say is, you know, for most registries, they're separate objects. And in fact, there's a separate lookup. In legacy Whois, there's a domain lookup, a name server lookup, and a registrar lookup. There's three types of lookups. And the name server lookup is a separate query. But it also, I mean, it's the basic functionality that DNS is providing. It's basically providing a lookup of a name to an IP address. And so that's available via, you know, the existing Whois functionality where you can do that. But that was a long explanation to get to the point that not all registries operate that way. In fact, EPP supports having name servers and domains as separate standalone entities, which is how most TLDs operate, but it also supports having name servers as a domain attribute. And that is allowed under EPP, and it is supported by our contracts. And I do know of some new gTLD operators that do that as separate entities, but as domain attributes. So I think that was maybe a lot more excruciating detail than maybe anybody needed or wanted, but maybe a long way of saying I think, you know, we need to make sure we're flexible enough in our writing to realize that there are some differences in how registries have implemented this and make sure the language allows for those other use cases.
Thank you, Mark. It sounds like this is an easy candidate for a TED topic. I'm joking. So I think what I'm hearing is that in terms of trying to document this in our table here, what I'm proposing that is, you know, under the transmission column, which is also known as the registry collection column, that I'll mark it as optional-CP for contracted party, and I'll put the following footnote that I've placed into the chat, and we'll keep that there. And then, of course, under disclosure, that would flip to required based in essence on the text of the footnote that, you know, if the registrant does supply it, then, of course, it would have to be disclosed out into the DNS. Any objections to that? I see a couple of agreements. Happy to reword the footnote if that doesn't sound right. Okay, hearing and seeing none. So let me just make sure I've got this updated. Delete the comment. All right, moving on. Yes, Stephanie published. Sorry. Okay, 1B also had, I think, one question here. And this is in our processing activity section. So again, the processing activity or the purpose here is about establishing the rights of the RNH. And based on what we've been trying to build out through the workbooks is making a better distinction in the realm of the disclosure processing activity of denoting who it's being disclosed to or published. And so I was a little bit confused about this specific purpose of establishing the rights of the RNH. Is data actually ever disclosed in that? And if so, you know, who should we label here in this processing activity as to who that data would be disclosed to. And my comment out to the right is very much that I believe Alan Woods had originally suggested in the 1B document that he sent that this be changed from disclosure to publication. So if I can just get some clarity there, then Alan, please go ahead.
Thanks. So with the publication one, yeah, that was just the product of an addled mind, I think. Yeah, no, it shouldn't be publication. And based on what we're talking about, disclosure is closer. So this one is, it's a difficult one because I still think that there are, in order to establish the rights of the registered name holder, we can easily say transfer and of the data. And again, because of the qualification that we have in this particular purpose, and that is subject to the terms and conditions qualifier at the beginning, and it's almost on the limitation of the benefits and the rights of the registered name holder, subject to those terms and conditions. So in my mind, where disclosure is envisaged, I think we probably need to be clear that because a lot of this, it would make more sense to me that disclosure is in very specific cases, that we might be required to disclose this data in circumstances such as perhaps law enforcement or being the obvious one. But also another disclosure which springs to mind straight away is if ever we were sued over an action that we took, applying terms and conditions, may it be in data protection or be it in otherwise, that we would probably need to disclose in those instances, which are as per law. I'm probably word souping it slightly, but in my mind, it seems more so on the edge of justifiable to leave in disclosure for these purposes, as opposed to removing it, if that makes sense to people. I don't know.
Thank you, Alan. And before I turn it over to Alex, so what I put in the chat, so just to kind of complete the statement, disclosure of registration data to third parties, will that be sufficient?
I suppose it is. No, I mean, it. Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't think it's necessary. Disclosure of registration data is disclosure of the controller. I would just leave it as disclosure for lawful purposes, in the sense of, again, this is, and I need to be very clear as well, this is disclosure vis-a-vis the registrar, vis-a-vis the registry or the registrar in whatever instance it is. It is for them to protect themselves, not for anything else. So they may need to disclose in order to protect them as controller.
Okay, understood. And so what's on the table is disclosure of registration data for lawful purposes. Alex, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. Yeah, it's Alex. Yeah, I think that was helpful, Alan. Thanks. This is good. That was, you know, my question was disclosure to who? And it sounds like it's just to registrars and registries in this case, which I guess is fine. I was also going to ask for if there were any kind of real-world use cases that describe when this disclosure would happen. And I think someone getting sued, a registrar or a registrar getting sued is a good one. Kind of helps zero in as to exactly what type of disclosure we're talking about and why. I'm just wondering if we may need to collect or at least document that one and perhaps think about a few more to make it clear to others outside of our small team here as to exactly what this disclosure or the specific purpose is all about. Thanks.
Right. Thank you, Alex. And Alan, did you want to come back on that or old hand? All right, good. Thank you. All right, let's move right along then. what I want to take you back for just real quick is the bottom of what is purpose 1A, and take a mental image of the DNSSEC, what I have listed there as optional for the registered name holder. The logic is if they did enable DNSSEC, then of course registrars and registries would be required to populate that data in a RDS and of course eventually disclose it should that ever happen. However, that is somewhat not congruent to what was listed in at the end of 1B. And I was just curious if we need to make sure that these two sync appropriately. So it would be, again, should it be optional for the registered name holder, and then under transmission and disclosure would be designated as required. All right, great. Thank you, Mark. So I'll just I'll reconcile 1B with what we have up in 1A. I just wanted to confirm that. And give me 1 second. I'm making these changes on the fly. Okay, this should move us down into purpose 2 next. And let me get my bearings real quick. Hold on, please. So, yes, all right, what I wanted to ask for purpose 2 is the fourth processing activity about retention of registration data. And this is listed as to be determined in how we have it documented under the processing activities. And noting how we have the retention documented up under purpose 1A and 1B, I was curious as it relates to purpose 2, which again is the enablement of responses to lawful data disclosures. Does retention need to be listed here, or would it, if I'm understanding things correctly, it would actually mimic the retention as listed under purpose 1A and 1B. Mark, please go ahead.
Sorry, I was actually I wasn't sure where we were, but I lowered my hand because I think you were looking at, we're looking at retention for purpose 2?
Correct. Right now, well, even since the initial report, this is this cell for this processing activity has always been blank. And so I was looking for a little bit of guidance about what these workbooks be saying as it relates to retention for this specific purpose.
Okay, then I guess my 2 cents is we wouldn't have any retention for this purpose, right? So we're not collecting data for this purpose or processing data for this purpose. We shouldn't be retaining it for this purpose, right? This purpose is about providing access to data, you know, collected, processed, and retained for other purposes. So I think it would be, you know, we want each of these purposes to stand alone, right? But I think it would be misleading if we just mirrored what's in purpose one. The reason why it would be retained is captured under purpose one. Putting a retention here implies that we're retaining the data for this purpose, which I think is inaccurate and maybe misleading. So my two cents, maybe Alan can clear things up.
Thank you, Mark. I think that's where I was heading, but Alan, please.
Thank you. I'm going to spare you my usual statements on this, but it's showing the other another difficulty as to why purpose two is, I would say, problematic as a purpose, and mainly because if we can set a retention period for this, but remember, it has to be specifically to do with the purpose. The minimum data set is for the purpose. We cannot draw from other purposes as to why we collect data for this, because that's not what a purpose is. So with that being said, we could set a retention period for this as a purpose, but that retention period would be specifically where the law tells us to retain for a period, because this is not a defined purpose by any stretch of the imagination. However, if the law said, hey, you as a registry or a registrar or ICANN, you must retain human data specifically for X amount of time just in case somebody needs to do it, well, then that would be our legal reasoning and basis for that. So in the absence of an actual law that directs a specific individual contracted party, there is no retention period associated with this. So that's my two cents.
Thank you, Alan. I added a placeholder text to populate this cell within the workbook, and I think I captured what we're talking about here. Note that the rationale for me bringing this up was more a logic question about whether this processing activity was required or not, and not so much about the content of what we're putting in the lawful basis cell. That'll kind of be our last step. So now we've got something a little bit to chew on, and we can come back and make more appropriate edits to these. To Sarah's question, so from two meetings ago, it was suggested that while there is a retention processing activity in our table of processing activities, we were not carrying it down to the actual data elements table and creating a specific column for it because it was redundant and confusing, but mostly redundant in that whatever data elements were going to be processed across collection, transmission, or disclosure would be those data elements that would be retained, or that there would be a retention purpose, retention duration set for that specific purpose. So that's why you'll see those removed across the entire document. Right. Let's move on now into purpose three. And I think there's really only one logic question that I had here. In the processing activity table, we're not going to go through it in detail today, but as we noted on the plenary call today, about making this distinction of a disclosure versus a publication being a subset of disclosure, and Mark did a good job about advising the plenary about, you know, this minimum public set of registration data. I don't want to spend time authoring it on the call. This will be homework for us over the next day or so. The first is, start thinking about what kind of rationale that would belong under the lawful basis for these two cells. And then further, I think it would behoove us to come up with a an appropriate term that we're going to call this minimum public set of registration data. If for anything else, just consistency, but I think that we should find a term that is easily recognizable, that doesn't stray away from the current understanding about, you know, what who is today versus what RDAP is tomorrow. And the reason why I say that is not only would we be documenting this in more detail here within the workbook, but this would refer back to Recommendation 8 that also talks about the redaction of certain data elements. And in that area, there's a specific mention about a public data or a public directory of registration data. So what we document here will be documented in that section of the final report, and that's why it's important. Mark, and then Alan, please.
Thanks, Barry. It's Mark. I'm going to put my vote in for minimum public data set. I think that's the term the NextGen RDS group used. So, you know, at the risk of stealing or confusing with what they did, that gets my vote here. And I think I had another point, but I forget what it is, so I'll stop talking and defer to Alan.
Thanks, Mark. Sorry, Barry, just confirm, are we still going with purpose two here?
Negative. We moved on to purpose three.
So much better. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know I've lost my train of thought because I was all dozed up for that. Okay. Yes. Minimum public data set of registration data. Yeah. I mean, this is one of these things that actually got them within the registries with relation to. Oh God, recommendation, insert number here. I can't remember which one. And it gets a bit, strangely enough, complicated. Because if we're talking about for three, yeah, the minimum public data set, sorry. Yeah, no, I just talked myself into a corner. I'm okay with that.
Great, thank you. One other thing that I'd like to bring up, I'm hesitant to bring up, but and perhaps Stephanie can also chime in on this. So, you know, certainly there has been discussion around, you know, certain data elements that are considered personal information are being redacted. There has been discussion in the working group about how an IP address or a name server or the domain name itself can be considered personal information and or personally identifiable information. I'm curious, should we make a statement as it relates to documentation? I'm not suggesting that this is a possible consensus recommendation, but should we document here in the workbook that at least those three data elements, while can be considered personal information or publicly identifiable information, that they must be published in their form as to allow for the DNS to work the way it was designed or something along those lines. I say this because it's fairly obvious to us here, but down the road, if a DPA where we're reviewing this documentation, it may not always be as clear to non-insiders. So I just thought I would put that out. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. Mark, you know, my two cents on this one has always been, you know, when it comes to stuff like this, it's best not to get too wrapped up in whether it's PII or not, because I think somebody can probably make an argument. You know, you can probably argue both sides of that for everything. So in cases where it's necessary to perform the service, and you know, and Alan saying that in chat basically is, you know, publication is absolutely necessary to achieve the fundamental purpose. you know, could a name server, you know, be personally identifiable? Could the IP address associated with that name server be personally identifiable? You know, I don't care because it's necessary to perform the service. The only remedy is to not obtain the service. There's no other way to accomplish the activation allocation of a domain name in the DNS. So I think that's, you know, hopefully an emphatic agreement with you, Barry, that we can all agree this is necessary to perform the service, and let's not get pulled into the debate on whether it's PIR or not. It's if it's necessary to perform the service, it's not necessary to have that debate.
Great. Thank you, Mark. And see, Alan has dropped his hand as well. All right. And just okay, so I think that was it for, oh no, it's not. So what I also wanted to show on purpose 3 is the next version of the data flow map. And again, I know that these are very high level. But what you'll see is an attempt, again, to document on the data flow map the appropriate processing activities. So, you know, obviously PA1 is collection of registration data from the registrant to the registrar. PA2 is there's some sort of transfer slash collection by the registry. Processing activity number 3 is to enable communications with the registrant. And as I understood from our call on Thursday, that, you know, specifically this is either the registry or the registrar that's doing this communication. And so I'm trying to reflect that in this data flow diagram with the red arrows pointing to the registrant. But then conversely, processing activity 4, which is this minimum public data set, where an internet user can do a query of registration data, that's, you know, reflected down at the bottom. And then, of course, the processing activity 5 and 6 talk about retention. So are there any concerns or consternations about how I've represented that in the data flow map, and we'll come back to data flow maps in general, but I did want to just highlight this since we had shifted these things down from purpose 2 into purpose 3. Mark, please go ahead.
Hey Barry, can I actually just get a second to confer with my registrar colleague on this? So can we get a quick pause?
Sure.
Hey, Barry. This is Mark. I'm going to ask Sarah to jump in after me to make sure I'm, you know, not saying something I'm not, I'm out of step on here. But I think what we want to reflect in this purpose three is, the disclosure steps here are the publication of the minimum public data set, right? The data elements that we're publishing in RDS, whatever flavor that may be. And I don't think it matters whether it's RDAP or who is. That's just the mechanism. What we're defining is the minimum public data set. And I think what we want to reflect here, though, is that, under GDPR, we don't want to have data transferred from the registrar to the registry just so it can be published in the public directory. We think that the data that the registry is authoritative for, they should publish, and the data that the registrar is authoritative for, they should publish, and that making the registry just a pass-through really is problematic under data minimization. And so I think what we want to make sure is reflected here is that we're not transferring the data from the registry to the registrar for this purpose, if that makes sense. And I'll kick it over to Sarah to make sure I've stated all that accurately and correctly.
Thank you. Yes. So I definitely agree with Mark that we do not want to transfer data just so that the registry can publish it. That's not a good plan. I'm feeling a little bit lost. The purpose statement doesn't, I can't even articulate what I'm lost with, but I agree with what Mark just said. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Sarah. Before I turn it over to Alex, I think this is probably something that should be discussed in the plenary as well. What you said, Mark, is, it reeks of RDAP ultimately, because then you're right, whether it's the registry or the registrar, they are likely going to be considered their own authoritative source for that data. However, I think an issue with that thought process, though, is the whole policy around thick who is, in that the concept there of thick who is was that the registry became the authoritative source, so to speak, at least as I understand, and I agree that certainly there is, as we know it today or knew it yesterday, is probably going to be something completely different tomorrow. At any rate, I'll stop there. Alex, and then Mark can come back and respond.
Sorry. Thanks, Barry. Yeah, you touched upon what I wanted to mention, which really is that the elephant in the room here is that we're setting policy that impacts, it actually negates this thick who is policy. And I Stephanie, I don't disagree that thick who is may be dead, but I don't think we can make a determination in this EPDP. That's way out of scope. We've been kind of dancing around this issue for a while. I think that this is, these decisions clearly will impact consensus policies that have been set elsewhere, and we just need to make sure that those issues are dealt in the PDPs, in the correct spot, and not here. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. And before I turn it over to you, Mark, I remembered something else I wanted to say, which I think where I may understand your discomfort is, and you're not necessarily trying, in your statement, you're not necessarily trying to negate FITCU is as a policy or not. You are stating, though, in terms of this specific purpose, you're not transferring that data or executing that processing activity of transfer as it relates to how the data would be disclosed for this specific purpose. You would only disclose it in terms of what data that you consider yourself the authority with, in terms of how you would communicate with the registered name holder as it relates back to this purpose. And if that's correct, then what I would suggest is that processing activity number two, which is really about the transmission of that data from a registrar to registry, that would be deleted, or I should say not required processing activity for this purpose, but so that we're trying to test my data flow map here, the processing activity three does show that the registry or the registrar in their own right is reaching out to the registered name holder as it relates to this purpose. So hopefully maybe I'm understanding your thought process. Go ahead, Mark.
Thanks, and this is Mark. I agree with what you said. Your first comment, your second comment, as well as what Alex said. You know, this is kind of the elephant in the room here. But I've not heard. You know, where I will disagree is I've not heard anybody say that this PDP can't change existing policies. In fact, I think we've all agreed that there may be impacts and we may need to change other policies. And it's hard to have a conversation about purpose three here without impacting the FITCU is policy. The FITCU is policy. You said in your initial response that, you know, as part of the FITCU is policy, it identified the registry as authoritative, required all data be transferred to the registry, and that the registry would publish that data in a public WHOIS directory in a consistent manner. You know, I'm paraphrasing here, all those things are impacted by what we're doing as part of this PDP, but none more so than here in Purpose 3. I think Alex is right. You know, we're making changes here, and we can't sort of tiptoe around the fact that we're making policy recommendations that impact this previous policy. We need to stop tiptoeing around that. Recognize the fact that we're impacting that, and just state what we're recommending and where the impacts are.
Thank you, Mark. And I'll just highlight, you know, something else, whether the group agrees that a current policy can be changed here or not. I would note, though, that it is clear that even if remove from Purpose 3 processing activity number 2 that speaks to the transfer of data from a registrar to a registry, that these data elements are being transferred for other purposes. And you'll see that in the consolidated tables that, you know, if we were to remove this one from, I think, page 3 of that PDF that I sent out, you would still see way over on the right that these data elements are still being transferred. We're just trying to be more precise here in that a transfer is not required to meet the intent of this particular purpose itself. Stephanie, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. And not to beat an already well-dead and rotting horse, but One of the reasons to have done a privacy impact assessment at the beginning of this exercise was not so much that the data is all that sensitive, as the GDPR says, but to help us better understand the ancillary policies that the GNSO Council is responsible for that need to be also changed. And so, for instance, we were talking today about the PPSAI policy and implementation, which will be impacted, and certainly THIC, as far as I'm concerned, THIC was dead as soon as I discovered it existed, and that was back in 2014, because it was already dead under the 95 directive. The reasons for its inception may have been valid when ICANN was first born, but they're not really valid outweighing the interests of the individual and the necessity test anymore, and I would argue haven't been valid for a number of years. So, you know, the first question I heard from the DPAs when trying to explain THIC to them one time at an IWGDPT meeting was, what's the necessity test? And that's, you know, you're hard-pressed to answer that one. So that's going to run through all of these other ancillary policies, and I think we owe it to the GNSO, who, to the best of my knowledge, because I raised all these issues when we were scoping the terms of reference for this PDP, the ePDP, that they haven't figured out a game plan yet for addressing all these other policies. You know, we're limping along with the who is conflicts with law, and it's not clear at all what that thing's going to look like. So, you know, I think the least we can do, I would hate to call them recommendations because that opens up another field of battle, but we could at least list all of the policies we stumble over and mention the areas where we think there's an impact and provide that as guidance to the GNSO Council. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie. Before I turn it over to Mark, I'll just note that we'll close this topic off in a minute or two. We'll pause for about 5 minutes for a bio break, and then we'll come back to this, or we'll move on to the next. So, again, what I you know, the elephant in the room conversation, I guess, is not shan't be had here, even though as is important as it is. So, again, what I'm proposing is that at least to meet the spirit of what Mark and Sarah are trying to point out is that at least in terms of this purpose, we don't need to document the transfer itself. That enabling of communications with the registered name holder will happen based on their own authoritative data, so that we're still showing that this potential for communications can happen with the registered name holder, but again, we'll just remove PA2 and state that the transfer of data is just not required to meet to fulfill this purpose. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks, Barry. It's Mark. And that, you know, and doing that for purpose three certainly, you know, addresses my concern for purpose three. So, frankly, I mean, I think, you know, I think my point here is that, we can't pretend that we haven't already impacted the THIC WHOIS policy. We've essentially agreed to remove the admin contact. We've changed the data that's collected for the tech contact. We are making new policy recommendations that, that are in complete conflict with the THIC WHOIS policy. We're not just talking about, the THIC WHOIS here, it's the THIC, it goes beyond that. That policy is being supplanted by this one, at least in part. If we want to refer it back to the GNSO so that they can reopen that, that's fine. I think we would be much better off just being clear that we're replacing that. As you said, that's more a decision for the full plenary and not something to bring up here. As we go through these purposes, you know, we need to be clear on what the processing activity is and what that what data needs to be processed to reach that or to achieve that processing activity, sort of the why that Stephanie just raised. If we don't have a why it's necessary, then we don't need to do it.
Thank you, Mark. And I'll just note it as an action item that perhaps we can bring this up Thursday, depending on what the agenda looks like. Yes, it's definitely a plenary discussion. Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you. I was definitely very valid. If we know that there's going to be an
Alan, you're coming in very faint.
Oh, okay. I don't know if that will help. Did that help?
Much better.
Oh, okay. Weird. Just computer weird. Okay, sorry. What I was saying is that I agree. I think if we know that there's going to be an actual impact, then there's nothing to stop us from saying, hey, we've definitely identified there's going to be an impact here and you should look at this. What I was going to say, and I was going to stray into weird positions where I was saying the transfer for three probably still is necessary, but then it just occurred to me that under purpose B, we could easily, as a registry and as a controller, have a secondary purpose that is related to the implication or the terms and conditions just in contacting the registrant using that data for that purpose. So, yeah, I'm not even going to complicate the matter. I think we're fine there. So I agree with Stephanie and Mark, kind of a hybrid of both.
Great. And, I think Sarah put into the chat that, enabling will happen based on the info already held by the contracted party. When we get to the consolidated workbooks, I'll point it out to you what that would look like for this. So let's take a 3 or 4 minute personal break, and we'll come back and we'll move on to the next item. Thank you. And for those that can hear, if you can give me a green check mark when you return, we'll get started. All right, great. Terry, you want to kick off the recording, please? All right. Thank you, everyone. All right, so next topic is purposes 4A and 4B. And they're both have the same logic issue that I just want to confirm with the group. And basically, as we had, you know, started at the beginning, our general principle was that each of these purposes needed to be viewed in isolation as though no other purpose existed. However, when it comes to escrow for registrars or escrow/EBORO for registries, we had also made a decision earlier in our deliberations that these two purposes aren't designed for actually collecting the data. It's going to be data collected in the aggregate from other purposes by which what data would be marked for escrow or escrowed, at least in the small subset of registration data. And so before I open up the queue, what I have in the Adobe Connect room now is for registrars. And specifically, what we have in the processing activity 2 column, what would be transmission, is only marked with those data elements as it's listed in the 2013 RAA for registrar escrow. Now, it's a little bit more complicated for registries in that not only do they have their own data that would be generated, but across the various purposes, there are some data elements that are transferred from the registrar to the registry as well. So their scope of data that would be escrowed is a little bit larger, and not to mention that when trying to actually read through the registry escrow agreement, it's practically impossible for anybody that's not super technical to figure out exactly what was being listed as required for escrow. And so ultimately what we did in the initial report was to take these consolidated tables that I'm referring to and that I sent out to us earlier, and was to basically select all of those data elements that were transferred or collected by the registry that would essentially populate processing activity 2 to capture that entire data set, and that in fact we would leave processing activity 1 collection blank, because as I noted earlier, there really isn't a need for the collection processing activity, because in the aggregate, it's really ultimately about whatever data is collected across the other purposes. So I just wanted to test this logic conundrum for purpose 4A and 4B and see if it's okay to continue as we have documented. Or conversely, then, we need to figure out how we're going to define what data elements are collected. Alan, and then Mark, please.
Thanks, Barry. You can hear me okay this time?
A little faint, but better.
Okay. Right. So don't hate me. But no. Again, because this is a purpose, we must document the entire life of that data process for that purpose. So even though it's collected for other reasons, it is also collected for this reason. So even though it's the exact same, by rights, and this is kind of an ICANN issue, to be perfectly honest, because
the minimum data set should only be that which is necessary for the registration and recovery of a domain name. So there's a lot of data elements potentially on both the registry and the registrar escrow requirements that are absolutely surplus to requirements. But generally speaking, those data elements are still collected for the purposes of escrow, as well as for the purpose of the registration of the domain, as well as et cetera, the other purposes. So we will still have to say, no, we collect from the very beginning this for escrowing the data as well. And of all the ones, this is probably one that's very, very vitally noted for collection, because me as a registry who has escrow requirements, I must insist that the registrar specifically are passing that on to the registrant and giving them actual notice that I will be transferring their data to a third person for the purposes of escrow. And that must be done at the point of collection, which is the same point of collection as most of the data. So no is the answer. We need to notify, we need to not notify, fill in the collection aspects of this. And I know that's difficult, because exactly as you pointed out, it's not an easy thing to figure out and discern what is necessary. But perhaps this is again another thing that needs to be punted onto ICANN or to the community and saying, hey, we really need to sort out what escrow is now absolutely necessary for the purposes that are stated for escrow in order to achieve escrow, the point of escrow, and that is the recovery of the zone in the event of a failure, or indeed in the triple lock failure across the registries and the registrars. Where it becomes even more difficult is this whole kind of collection from the registry point of view, of course, because technically we get into that whole thing of collection by the registrar is not collection by the registry. It's transfer by the registrar, which is collection by the registry. And therefore, there will be two different sets of collection for the registrar. That is the escrow collection for the registrar's purposes only, and then the escrow collection for the registry's purposes. So that just gets just a little bit crazy. So apologies.
Great. Thank you, Alan. And I think Sarah is in agreement. She had lowered her hand. Before I go to Mark, and hopefully by my intervention here, he can lower his hand. So what I'm proposing, which is really what happened here with the 4B Bravo for registries, how I came up with the list that is currently listed as required is from this tool, and I wanted to save it in all of its grandeur, but essentially looking at the consolidated table and looking far to the right where there's a collection logic, anywhere that it's green or yellow, yellow meaning that there's some sort of optional to it, it was hard to decipher it amongst the three different optional options that we have. But ultimately, if I were to filter this list out and it only contained the green or yellow indications, that would give me all of the data elements that are collected by a registrar that would then actually be populated into 4A PA1, the processing activity for registrars. And then conversely, the same thing would happen for registries, and now you see that how it changes and that the registries is slightly a little bit more complex because it no longer matters if there's an optional collection at the registrar. If there is a data element that's populated, then that becomes and it's transferred to the registry, then that becomes a required element for the registry. But in essence, the same would apply for 4B, and that when I filter out this list, I can then identify all of those specific data elements that are collected by the registry, and I would populate those into the first column for PA1 under 4B. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. It's Mark. I'm pausing, so I'm trying to sort of digest what all you just said, and I'm not entirely sure I followed all of it, and maybe I just have to look at this a little bit offline. And I was also listening to what Alan said. I mean, I raised my hand because I was going to take a slightly different tack to sort of making the same point on the registry escrow. I spent a bit of time, you know, when we first looked through escrow following LA, I spent a decent amount of time looking at the specification. And I think I reported back to the group that there were over 100 fields on there. And I see Stephanie's got her hand up. I mean, this specification, you know, sort of flies in the face of, you know, privacy by design and data minimization. I think that escrow specification was written by, was probably devised and come up with by engineers who were looking at, you know, all the things you could do and not necessarily considering what you needed to do and what was necessary from a GDPR and data minimization standpoint. So, you know, I think, when DPAs were talking about the need for privacy by design, I think maybe they might have had this escrow specification in mind when they were writing that. So I think that needs to factor into our recommendations. I think we can't be collecting and escrowing data because it's in an escrow specification. I think we need to make sure we have a clearly defined GDPR compliant purpose for why that data element is processed. Otherwise, we shouldn't be collecting it. And I think that's where our recommendations need to end up along with this purpose.
Thank you, Mark. Stephanie, go ahead, please.
Stephanie Perrin, for the record, not to beat that rotting horse again, but and correct me if I'm wrong, obviously I'm not the technical person here, but I regard this as clear and simply ICANN's purpose. As steward of the DNS, have a responsibility and they are accountable for making sure that in the event of market failure, the registrant and the domain names are protected and reinstated with another registrar registry. Therefore, I see this as clear and simple. ICANN's the controller. The data processor is under the control of ICANN, whoever that data processor is, whoever the escrow bureau agent is. And if it isn't now under contract, it should be, right? And the registrars are more or less out of the loop, except that this purpose is added to all the other purposes which they have, but for gathering the data, that is. But it's a very, very thin set of data. I mean, I agree with Mark. That's a ridiculous amount of data to keep for escrow purposes. It's more like a security wonk's dream, not anybody sensible. You don't surely need all that to reinstate a domain. So you have to winnow that down to the very tiny data set that is required to enable a new provider, registrar or registry, to reconstitute, and you're done, right? So on this one, I think it's essential that we clarify who's the controller and who the processors are, and what the role of the escrow bureau providers are, and what kind of agreement you're going to sort with them under the GDR controller and processor agreements. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie. And I'll note that, you know, this does tie back to, I can't remember the recommendation numbers, but having to do with roles and responsibilities, and as well as the escrow recommendation of getting into proper data processing arrangements / agreements. Those are connected. And before I turn it over to Alex, what I'll do for the next version of the workbooks, and I know that I probably failed miserably in trying to eloquently explain how I would filter out the table in the view, but I'll show you what I did in the next version of the workbook, and I'll try to document where it came from these consolidated tools that populates that collection processing activity. Alex, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. Yeah, I think we just have to keep in mind that this purpose is a purpose to safeguard, right, the user's registration data, right, the rights of the user, and to make them whole when things go awry. So just responding to the comment from Stephanie, I think just looking at the green and yellow cells in that doc that just disappeared, it seems to me to be the right one to ensure that when a failure happens, that a user can quickly get back up and running with their domain name without having to go back and fill in data that may be important or necessary to ensure that their DNS entry is working correctly, or that the data that they want to make available in any future RDDS is also transferred over. So it seems to me that from a data element point of view, at least, we have the right set. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a very quick point, just to add to what Stephanie is saying there, and I said it in the chat already, and I completely agree with her. In this instance, both the registrars and the registries would be processors to ICANN's controllership. And the simple test for that would be, you know, would we use an escrow? Would we go through the hoops of escrow if we didn't have it as an obligation or contract? And to yell from the pillars, hell no. Because every proper business in this day and age who uses data as their core will always have their disaster recovery and their backups offline and things like that. That would be our controllership of it. The escrow is like another lock on top of that. So this is a very, very difficult one. And I said that the cart is truly before the horse in this one, because it really is. And again, this is one of those areas where it would be nice to get the guidance of a proper contract, as Stephanie's pointing out, that would tell us, well, what exactly is necessary in this instance. So I do think that this is definitely something we need to flag with the plenary, and needs to be flagged with ICANN, saying, you know, we can't really come to a solid recommendation on this one, but we tried our best, and the gaps should be filled in by the endeavors of ICANN in coming to a proper data controlling or data processing arrangement with all the parties involved.
All right, thank you, Alan. Noted, and like I said, I'll update these PA1 so that at least we get the workbook in as close to order as we can. And then secondarily, I mentioned it as a possible topic to discuss with plenary, but I'll remind that I think we have the essence of that captured in our recommendations in the final report. The proof is in the pudding as to what happens afterwards. All right, I'm going to move to purpose number 5, and this one is about contractual compliance, and I know that there's still some outstanding issues being discussed at the plenary level about this. There are a couple of sidebar comments that I won't go into detail now, but they were suggested by Alan Greenberg as part of the discussion about the ARS. I still have them highlighted. We won't go through them in detail for today's call until that gets resolved at the plenary. But I did have one question that I wanted to ask your input on, and that's specifically around processing activity 3, the disclosure of registration data. And it it kind of harkens back to the limitation of our workbook and the role changes that occur when data is transferred from A to B. A is transferring, B is technically collecting. So that kind of same breakdown is occurring here, that data is collected from registries or registrars at the request of ICANN contractual compliance, that data is transferred to them, and then subsequently contractual compliance would process that data. So as it's currently documented here, processing activity number two is the act of that data being transferred to ICANN org. Should we also document that data is being disclosed, noting that it's practically the same thing that's occurring in PA2, or is it sufficient just to note that the processing is actually occurring under PA2 and thus not documented as a disclosure? Any thoughts or questions about that? I'm inclined to just repeat it for the sake of consistency for anything else. But again, it really is just a repetition. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. It's Mark. So a couple things there. With compliance, compliance is a specific contractual obligation, and so I would not want to intertwine it with purpose two. My inclination, I guess I'd be open to if others had arguments to the contrary, but my inclination is to keep it separate from purpose two. I think that's a third party disclosure, whereas this compliance disclosure is occurring specifically under the terms of the contract between the registry and registrar and ICANN. And so I think it's rightly belongs in a separate task. I'm having a little trouble with collection some data is collected per the terms of our contract at the direction of ICANN as the controller for sure, but I don't think in any of those instances is the data collected for the purpose of compliance. I hate using the term secondary purpose because it doesn't really have a legal basis, so it's just kind of a notion. But I hate using it, but I'm struggling with the right words here, and so I'm going to throw that out here and say this is a secondary processing activity. ICANN compliance is performed on data and on domain registrations that are occurring in accordance with other purposes and other processing activities. And so I'm struggling a little bit with how that processing activity one is laid out there, but I do think keeping it separate and treating it as own purpose is the way to go. And I also think, just I guess for what it's worth, ARS, I look at ARS as a compliance function, but also based on contract terms. The accuracy, particularly on the registrar side, are included in 2013 RAA. So those are contractual obligations. So, here as well, I think this compliance activity is the right place for the ARS activities to reside.
Thank you, Mark. And, so I'm just kind of ready and waiting for the final green light from the plenary to make some of these edits that were suggested by Alan Greenberg in terms of finding a proper home for ARs, which, again, I think was not to be part of the actual research purpose recommendation. I'd also note that, I was specifically talking about the processing activity, so if I did misspeak or misspoke, I didn't mean to refer to other purposes, but again, the processing activity of PA3 of disclosing, but I think Sarah makes the point that we're probably fine in how we have it documented under PA2 as the transfer of this data to contractual compliance. And then I'll just make a note in disclosure that that's really covered under transmission and that we should be all right there. Stephanie, please go ahead.
Thanks, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. And you've heard me make this point or try to a million times already. This kind of accuracy requirement is disproportionate. And, I mean, the accuracy that the compliance folks are actually testing. And it's not necessary. If the registrars don't have a problem, then why should anybody else? And the answer to that is third parties have a problem. Now, I don't think that that is going to engender any sympathy on the data minimization side. You do not put this kind of response burden on the registrants solely because third parties would like more accurate data. I can think of numerous examples in other sectors where other actors in the ecosystem would like accurate data as to, for instance, how much money I owe, whether a check is going to clear the bank. They don't get it. You know, they have to take a risk. I know. We can't resolve it. I'm reading Barry's comment there. But I'm just, this thing has a life of its own that continues on in utter disregard for how a court or a data protection commissioner is going to view this. And I just want to put a great big bullseye on this one. We need to constrain this somehow, and it just keeps floating along. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie. And Mark?
Thanks, Barry. What I was going to say is pretty much complementary to what Stephanie was going to say. You know, I do think ARS is a part of this purpose, but not in the way that Alan Greenberg is envisioning it. You know, and he's not here to defend himself, so apologies for that. But, you know, he's looking for unlimited access to the data and, you know, and also looking for it to extend beyond the life of the registration, and that's out of scope. You know, it's, you know, accuracy in ARS is fine as part for this purpose as long as it's within the within the contractual limitations of what compliance is asking for. You know, I'm going to respond to Alex. I mean, I don't know. He's not, you know, Alan's not here to defend himself, but I understand what he's looking for to be sort of a back door, if you will, the ARS system to have access to unredacted RDS data so that it can, you know, parse, all the data. You know, I think he's looking to build in a back door for this. And it's, you know, from my perspective, that's beyond the scope of what the contracts allow. And also, you know, it appears to be beyond the scope of what ICANN.org is looking for. You know, we've asked them questions from this, on this a couple times. And I think, you know, if you look, if you look at their response for, bulk registrar, data access, they look to limit that to only the information that was specifically requested. Stephanie's noting, well, yeah, the liability would be theirs, right? And I'm sure, I know we have Dan and Trang on the call, and So I shouldn't presume to speak for them, but I'm sure they're doing their own liability assessment. And you know, it's not clear to me that they're asking for this. It doesn't seem that they are. So I support having the ARS as part of this purpose, but only so far as is necessary to achieve the purpose and is allowed within the terms of contracts. So just sort of responding to what Stephanie said in support of that.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Noted. I think I got what I needed in terms of completing that part of the workbook, and I listed this down as a potential item that we can take back to the plenary that we'll include with the notes. So we have about 20 minutes remaining. I'd like to definitely spend a little bit of time on Purpose 6. We haven't discussed it much yet. And it's probably one of my most favorite, only because, again, I'm a self-proclaimed black belt expert in UDRP URS since I've been on that PDP. I think mostly what I wanted to talk with this group about first is the structural change that was made to this workbook. And Alex, I know that you and your colleagues still have some input on this. Hopefully, this revised version will help in some of your group's deliberations about this. But ultimately, I think what I'll do first, again, is just to remind everybody the processing activities going on here. The first one, being that, there is, I guess first and foremost, this purpose is complicated in that it has several DRPs combined into one. And what I tried to make note of here is that most of this workbook is focused around UDRP, URS, and TDRP. The other two DRPs haven't necessarily been used, and so it's difficult for us to nail down exactly what registration data might be used for those. So I put a small disclaimer in there that the structure of this workbook is mostly around the first three, and that when the other two are invoked, if they ever are, that will provide better visibility about what potential registration data may be required to meet those. The first processing activity, again, is the collection of this data from registrars and registries that would be necessary to process a complaint in UDRP, URS, and TDRP. Not to neglect the other two processing activities, but you'll see a 6PA1 Zulu, Z as in Zulu, to still note documentation around the RDDRP and the PDDRP, but again, that they're not being connected to the data flow diagram or the data elements table itself. So then you'll see that we drop down into processing activity 2, which is essentially the transfer of data from a registrar to a registry. But then where it gets fun is starting with processing activity 3, and that's the transmission of this registration data to dispute resolution providers. Again, you'll notice the PA3Z, singling out the other two DRPs that are not a part of the structure. And then we start getting into the disclosure of the registration data used for complaints to the complainant from the dispute resolution provider. And then ultimately, which wasn't properly documented, was the publication of that registration data on completed complaints. And then there's also some a further breakout on the retention of this, and we'll come back to retention in a little bit. So ultimately, what we have here from the data flow map, again, you know, the registries or registrars, I'm looking at processing activity three, what is kind of highlighted in purple, and that, you know, these specific data elements are being transferred to the providers. In some cases, pardon me, in some cases that data is disclosed to the complainant, especially in cases like where privacy proxy were an issue, which already exists today.
Apologies.
Sorry about that. And that, again, then further, when you look at PA5, which gets into the publication of minimal data elements with that UDRP or URS case. So as it breaks down into the data elements table, you'll see that essentially there's required almost across the board from either data being collected or transferred to the provider and then ultimately disclosed to the complainant. But the different nuances, processing activity number five, which is the publication of that complaint on a provider site, and you'll see that there's really just a thin version of what is actually published, which would be the domain name, the registrar, the registrant name and organization if it's provided, as well as the city, state, and country. That is what currently exists today. When I reviewed through the WIPO and ADR forum sites. So I think what's good about this version is that it fully documents the end-to-end transaction of a UDRP URS complaint. So I just wanted to highlight some of those changes because this is probably one of the ones that have changed the most from our initial report. So I'll stop there. Mark, please go ahead.
Hey Barry, Mark Anderson. I feel like I'm at a risk of being predictable on this call here, but I'm raising my hand on the transfer from the registrar to the registry processing activity. You know, I'll just try and put it as clear as I can. If we're just transferring the data to the registry so that they can be a pass-through to send it on to somebody else, then it's probably not necessary and appropriate under GDPR. You know, that processing activity can and does happen without the registry's involvement. So, you know, for this purpose, it's not necessary to transfer data from the registrar to the registry to achieve the UDRP URS purposes. And we should update it to reflect it.
Thank you, Mark. And I have noted that I will make that change because you're right. It does fall exactly in line back with Purpose 3, which was enabling communication with the registered name holder. So I will blank out processing activity 2. There was another point I wanted to make. About this one. Oh, it'd help if I was looking on the right purpose for my own document. Sorry about that. So, yes, I'll make that update. And then the second thing that I wanted to mention as it related to this had to deal with the retention of this data as it evolves through its different stages. So the retention of registration data from contracted parties is not necessary for this particular purpose workbook. But now that data is being processed by a dispute resolution provider, in essence, it's being processed by a complainant in cases where they would receive that registration data and amend their complaint. And then thirdly, there's also the retention of the data as it relates to how it's being published on the data or the dispute provider sites. So, and I don't think that we were very precise when we were building these workbooks as far back as in Los Angeles, but should we provide more information here about how that data should be retained? So, for example, WIPO completes a UDRP complaint that the complainant prevailed. The full registration data that they would receive from a contracted party, how long should they be holding on to that full data set? Secondarily, how long should the complainant be retaining that data for the purpose of, for achieving this purpose? Should we put in some notes about it? Or secondarily, or as another option, is this something that is even within the scope of this group in terms of trying to document what those retention requirements should be? And then lastly, you know, as it relates to the publication of complaints on a provider's site, I think in some cases the DRPs themselves are considering themselves controllers and would probably have a processing activity defined about how long that particular data would be retained. And I'll just note that there are some sidebar comments that I've included into the workbook that were supplied from WIPO as it relates to the publication of data on the complaint. But again, as you know, so just to restate the question that I'm asking you is, should we provide information as to how long data should be retained by the provider and or the complainant? I'll stop there. So, Alex, please raise your hand, please speak. And I'd also like you to respond if this structure aligns more with what your colleagues have been discussing amongst yourselves. Alex, please go ahead.
Yeah, so it's Alex. I think the data flow map is better, and I think it more accurately reflects what's going on. It seems to me that the key piece here is this whole MOU-DPA, right, which will no doubt, I assume, further detail things like retention. It seems to me that that is where those type of details will be laid out. I'm glad you found or worked with WIPO to find that language. That's something that I had found, and the forum has something similar, which is helpful. And I guess the last, this is more of a question, is in the data flow map, which you have up there, is that arrow correct between complainant and UDRP provider versus PA4, or should it go the other way?
Thank you, Alex. I guess, to be honest, I didn't have a diehard principle about the directions of arrows. I'm sure that it's probably somewhat inconsistent.
Okay.
I guess I could probably get arrows on both ends. The original intent was that the complainant was filing the complaint with the provider, but I should probably put an arrow back to the complainant because, in essence, they could be collecting data that is being transferred to them from the provider.
That's right. Yeah, that's kind of what I had in mind here. So I think if we did that, that would make sense to enable the so-called John Doe situation.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I was in my painting masterpiece. That's the beautiful. What I was going for.
Right. So you know, I think this looks good to me. I haven't had a chance to discuss this update with the experts, which, as I've mentioned in the past, I am not. So I've been taking notes, and I'll plan to send this latest version to them today with a bunch of specific questions, specifically where do the providers get their data from? Is it just the registry, is it just the registrar, or do they ever get it from the registry? This goes back to the question and the issue that that Mark raised. So I just want to validate where things stand and how things work currently. It doesn't mean that means that they have to work the same way moving forward. And then I'll make sure that they're comfortable with the data elements table for disclosure and publication, as you've done. And then I'll ask about retention and confirm with them if they feel that would be something that would be specified. Well, it's either specified now in some contract, or if that would be further specified in the data processing agreement that is still to be defined. It's not clear to me how that works. But so those are the questions I'll be asking of them, and I'll make sure I respond back to the list as soon as I can.
Thanks, Alex. A few comments in response. Hopefully I can remember these. First, wait a few hours after this call so I can make updates to this version so you can send over the latest example.
Okay.
The reason why, well, so part of my update again will be to blank out the transfer processing activity, PA2. But in terms of today's current environment, for the most part, or, you know, probably almost as near 100% as you can get, when a UDRP is filed, the provider will contact the registrar for that information. And that's just the way that it's always worked. In URS, the rules and procedures specifically state that the provider should contact the registry. My understanding, that was primarily because registries were considered authoritative because the URS was part of the new GTLD registry agreement and the 2013 registrar accreditation agreement, but that, you know, with a thick who is environment, the registry would be considered the authoritative source and thus them contacting a registry. You know, ultimately, this is probably more a policy question for an RPM group as to who's the best, you know, the best to be contacting for this information. And it occurs on a couple of different levels, but, you know, does it make sense that perhaps all UDRP URS requests should flow to the registrar as opposed to a combination of the registry or registrar? Those are some questions that can be figured out elsewhere. But ultimately, under today's state, URS predominantly will be requested from a registry, UDRP requested from a registrar. Hence, both purple lines flowing from the registry and registrar for those particular types of DRPs. To Stephanie's point about who the controller and the processor is, I think in a generic sense, it's probably ICANN is a controller and the DRPs are processors. However, that is complicated given today's current environment where URS providers do have an MOU, and perhaps that can be a vehicle for some sort of DPA, but in terms of UDRP providers, there's no agreement nor an MOU, and so the discussion of who would be a controller and processor, I think, is even more complicated, but that is something that would, as I understand, would be worked out in the implementation phase of adhering to the recommendation about creating GDPR compliant types of arrangements across these parties. So it will be worked out. But I think in terms of what we're trying to accomplish in the workbooks today is a general notion of a controller processor arrangement, again, not knowing that, you know, the probably the details that we should. Mark, please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. It's Mark. You know, and your middle, I raised my hand to respond to Alex's question on current practice, and I agree with what you said. And, you know, in the cases of UDRP, generally, you know, the UDRP provider goes to the registrar. On the URS, I'll just clarify a little bit. You know, URS as a rights protection mechanism is a construct of the new GTLD program, and so it was written for new GTLDs as part of the new GTLD program, and it's and those new GTLDs were all envisioned to be fixed. So when it was written, the URS policy itself specifies that the URS provider would go to the registry. So that's written in the in the URS language itself, and that's the practice that URS providers follow for URS complaints. As you said, that's not the way it has to be, and maybe isn't even the best way for that to be done. There are functions, and, you know, under a URS proceeding, there are things that a registry has to do. There are tasks for a registry to perform. So the URS provider would need to go to the registry. But as far as disclosure of non-public data, you know, I would certainly suggest that going to the registrar is the more appropriate path for that. But hope that's helpful background for you.
All right, thank you. So I think we've talked through this one. We're already over time, so in the next version, just review through Purpose 7. That one's pretty straightforward. I don't think there's anything contentious here other than maybe Mark highlight to Christina that I've got one little sidebar about the disclosure of registration data as it meets for this purpose. I could use some clarity around that. The last thing that I'll just quickly talk about, which was this consolidated table, and take a little bit closer look at it when you get a chance. So page one, again, is really just about in the aggregate, what data is being collected by the registrar. The second page is what data is being transferred to the registry or, aka, collected by the registry and generated. So that's a particular view. The third page is really just kind of a repeat of page one. In essence, what is being collected at the registrar if there is a transfer of data to the registry, it would be those particular data elements. So that one's almost kind of, again, it's really repetitive based on our current logic in the workbooks. I think page four is very important as it relates to the disclosure or really the publication of data. And this is a pretty big change from what we had documented in these tables at the time of the initial report. But what I do like about this is that it is a very clear picture now about what is truly going to be published on this freely available directory out there. So take a little bit closer look at that. And then lastly, this one is hard to see in the Adobe Connect room, but this is a first example of the screenshots that will be included back with the recommendations in the main body of the final report. So for example, recommendation 4 is about what data is going to be collected from a registrar. We're going to need to update recommendation 4 to also highlight what data elements are collected slash generated by the registry. In terms of recommendation 5 about the general, you know, transfer of data from a registrar to registry and the baggage around thick who is, but that's contained in there. And then lastly, on recommendation 8, which is the last page of this PDF, would be the screen capture that would be presented when it's talking about what data elements would be redacted, as well as this minimum public data set. So I'll stop there. Like I said, in the next couple of hours, I'll work on the next version of the draft and get that out. I right now, we don't have a meeting scheduled for Thursday. Do we need one, or do we think that we can wrap up the rest of this over the list?
Yeah, let's try to wrap things up over the list if we can.
All right, excellent. All right, so any parting complaints, gripes, thoughts? If not, we'll call this a close. Thank you for your participation, and you'll see some meetings or some emails on the list. Thank you again. Take care.
Thanks, Barry.
Cheers.